This morning's reading from the Acts of the Apostles continues the very high drama. We've had stories, amazing stories so far, and that doesn't slow down. There's never a dull moment in the lives of the small band of missionaries who are venturing out into uncharted territory to plant new church starts. They never knew who they were going to meet or how God was going to grow in and through them or other people. Strange and amazing things were happening, and they were beginning to expect that. As I was meditating on this story for the last few weeks, I was so aware how incredibly relevant it is to this day and time. Issues of slavery, captivity, political prisoners, state-sponsored terror, and God's saving acts in, through, and around us to save souls and lives of God's people. How do we make sense of all of that? How do we apply it? How do we take the word on the page and lower it to our hearts so that it comes out in our own lived experience? I would like to share three experiences for me that as I meditated on this passage, I continue to mull over. Three things that happened this week as church for me. The first was Wednesday afternoon when I went to the shelter for the migrant children who crossed the border unaccompanied. Every time I go, there are more children. The Catholic priest doesn't come anymore. And there's from 80 to 280 people, kids, I'm told, that are there. They've been apprehended without any adult family member, and most of them have come from Guatemala or Honduras or El Salvador, very few of them from Mexico alone. Conditions must be so incredibly terrible where they are that someone paid for them to come alone. And they don't ride a bus or a car or get in a train. They ride on top of a train or on the side of the train. They hold on to it. Studies show that about half of them never make it. Either they are taken in by human traffickers or they are felled by low-hanging wires on the trains or pushed off by gang members or starve or are trampled. You know, all kinds of things happen to them. So the kids that are sitting there in front of us have been through hell and back. This time I went with Sharon Nix, and she doesn't speak Spanish, but you can see God's face there in these kids. From 12 to 17, this group of 59 were 50 boys, all of them from Guatemala, and 9 girls from other countries, 1 from Mexico. The injustice of that, children crossing the desert alone because of the violence and the poverty in their own communities, and they're in a shelter where they'll either be sent back to their country, half of them are, to deplorable conditions where their lives will only get worse, or they'll be sent to family members, probably not their parents, where their lives are going to change forever. And it's going to be difficult for them because they can still be deported. What is our role as church? What is my role as pastor being there? What was Sharon's role but to mother, right? To parent kids who had lost their parents, who were separated from their parents. But what can we do that's more than that? If these were our children, if we really acted as if we were one people, wouldn't we be changing that situation? The second worship service was the same night, Wednesday night. We had 20 people here for the healing from sexual assault service. About half were not members of our church. We came together to break the silence. Davin Franklin Hicks shared an incredible piece that he's written for the United Church of Christ Southwest Conference blog, and we watched the digital reflection that he showed a couple of weeks ago. It was a very moving service of candlelighting and a time when we came together to say something terrible has happened and the church has been complicit in the silence around it. We're not talking about sexual assault as a sin, as an injustice, as something that hurts us all, perpetrator and victim alike. But we did that night. And the 20 of us that were there knew that our prayers have reverberated out into the community and that it mattered, certainly mattered for those of us who were there. But But what is this story that we read today, that we heard today from Acts and the reading from John mean? What does it call us to do? The third experience was yesterday. I went to Phoenix for an all-day meeting for what used to be called the Mission Planning Board. And I think that it's going to be called Mission Planning and Church Vitality Group. There were heated discussions about the purpose of this group. Did we come together just to share information about what we were doing in our churches or what the conference is doing and feel good about that and support each other in our activities as church? Or were we there to talk about mission? How what we were doing in mission as the hands and feet and bodies and voice of God, of Christ in our churches? And there was some push and pull about that. Some churches didn't want to have anything to do with that mission conversation. They didn't come to do social justice. They didn't do that in their UCC church. See, it doesn't happen in all UCC churches. They really wanted to rename the group Congregational Connections or Congregational Communications. Well, that's all and good, but it doesn't say anything about Jesus. I mean, it doesn't say anything about our work of the church. Mission, I think, is still a very relevant plan. This is the most powerful board in the Southwest Conference of the UCC. It's actually a standing committee that advises the board of the Southwest Conference on what our mission might, could, should be. It's a very important piece of work there, ministry. Something I certainly want to be a part of if that's the way it goes. I fear, though, that in this day and time when people are running from mission, when they want to talk about feeling good and just talk to us folks, our people, that we might dilute that body. So pray for us. I think the passages today tell us something about that. I pray that my words this morning and the words from the readings lower to our hearts, and we can discern as individuals and as church our next right steps in ministry and mission. Last week's reading from Acts, we met Lydia, who was a Gentile woman of considerable means who brought herself and her whole household to faith in Jesus Christ with a group baptism held in the midst of great joy. It was a surprising congregation that Paul found outside the city gates. He spoke to them. They listened, and they were all changed by it. Paul and his entourage, including Silas and the narrator of the story from Acts and others, must have been feeling pretty good about how things were going so far in their ministry in Philippi. They followed their routine of going to the place of prayer, perhaps down by the river where they had met Lydia, or maybe even to a synagogue in the center of the city. On one regular trip to a place of prayer, Paul kept encountering this woman who was very different from Lydia. While Lydia was a woman of position and many possessions with her own household and a business to run, this other woman was young, probably even a girl. Our text translates the Greek to household worker, but I think a better translation and more commonly used is slave girl. She was possessed by a spirit of divination, the story tells us today. But the listener can actually see that she's possessed and exploited by the businessmen or handlers who had power over her, who turned her gift of prophecy to profit themselves. Biblical scholars describe such people as diviners. They were usually women who were believed to have had special powers to see into the future, but also to be able to see things that others might miss. This girl was a lucrative small business enterprise for the men who owned her. Like so many girls, even today, she was exploited by those who had figured out a way to make money on her. But every time she saw Paul and Silas and the missionaries, she blurted out loudly, "These people are faithful followers of the Most High God." She saw them. She got them. Maybe, you know, that underground railroad of information that happens, maybe she had heard about them before they even got there. That kind of word travels fast, right? Maybe she knew, and the minute she saw them, she called them out. She outed them as missionaries for Jesus Christ, Jews for Jesus, if you will. It was unsolicited proclamation by Paul and Silas. Our story tells us that Paul finally got angry and called the Spirit out of her, but maybe he was scared. Remember, we're in Macedonia, which is where Philippi is located. It's a Roman colony. The emperor of Rome had just banished all the Jews from Jerusalem. So being a Jew, as Paul had been, and being a Jew for Jesus was even worse, was dangerous. Dangerous. And she was outing them. But in calling the Spirit out of her, he also freed her with a word. She no longer had the gift that could be exploited. She did what she did at great risk to herself. Luke tells us that the girl persisted to reveal their purpose until Paul finally acted. The text tells us the Spirit left her that moment, and she disappears. We don't hear from her anymore. Perhaps by being set free from the gift that made her profitable to her keepers, she was able to leave them and go to worship down by the river with Lydia and her sisters outside the gates of Philippi. But probably not. Perhaps because she was no longer of use to her keepers, they put her to other more degrading work. We know what happens to the prostitute or the shoe shiner or the child that sells chiclets in Latin America or the windshield washer. When they're no longer an asset to their pimps, they're beaten up, they're disappeared from the streets, sometimes they're killed. We don't know what happened to her, but we do know that another nobody was somebody in God's eyes. She saw and heard God's good news, and she wanted more of it. She risked everything for it. She announced its coming as any prophet would do, but because of her social status, she was easily disappeared without a trace from the story and from our story. This girl was a prophet. She did what others had done, but because of her status, she is not recognized as such. We know that when the girl's keepers realized that they could no longer profit from her work, they had Paul and Silas arrested. There was this building energy that began with the thwarted businessmen and the authorities there and the crowds. And it all began with these words. These people are Jews and are disturbing the peace by advocating practices which are unlawful for us Romans to accept or practice. Angry because they lost business due to Paul and Silas's response to the slave girl, they called these men out as these people. You know what happens when that happens. Their words are deliberately meant to scapegoat Paul and Silas for their ethnic identity. These people are Jews. Mob mentality took over as they were stripped and beaten with rods and severely flogged. These words are a chilling reminder of pogroms of the past, of violent riots aimed at massacre, of persecution of an ethnic or a religious group, particularly one aimed in our history at Jews of Russia and Europe. But it goes on from anti-Semitism, which is still alive today, to Islamophobia, anti-refugee or migrant, or anti-LGBTQ rhetoric. We hear words like these people and us Romans and worse in the news today with different names and stories. But the intention is the same, to reduce a human being to a thing, feared and hated, to incite violence, to eliminate the alleged threat to peace and prosperity of the dominant culture. These people versus us Romans echoes in our world today, in which people are scapegoated, arrested, tortured, imprisoned, deported, or killed for their perceived otherness. Ethnicity, race, religious practice, gender identity, sexual orientation, different physical and mental abilities. We know how that happens. It's a terrible, terrible thing that gets hold of people who probably wouldn't do those kinds of things by themselves, but in a mob, yes, they will, and we see that rising in our culture today. Paul and Silas were whipped many times and thrown into prison, and the jailer was told to keep a close eye on them. We know in the prison industrial system that we have that the jailers, the keepers of the keys, are often people who are underpaid, who are part of the oppressed class, who are unappreciated, who themselves are captives to the jobs they hate but have to have. So we can imagine how that jailer must have felt, told to tie them to the ground with a stake. It brings to mind Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. It's not too far from the practices of our own prison industrial complex. If you've seen the migrants as they come in for their hearings, little migrants who've been found in the desert, hungry and weak, and they're cuffed and shackled despite their emaciated status. Paul and Silas, despite their having been beaten and chained to the floor, begin to sing and pray. They sing and pray. They refuse to let their souls be held captives. Have you ever done that? Have you ever refused to let your soul be held captive? Have you ever stood with people who refused to let their souls be held captive, even though maybe they were? The few times that I've been arrested while protesting with some amazingly wonderful people who dedicated their lives to such things, I was in cells with nuns and priests and other activists who sang and prayed and served communion and sang Kumbaya. It was so apparent that these were good, good people. And I know the jailer saw it, and you could see the hearts turn in some of them. But they had a job to do, and they couldn't risk losing it. Then there's God's intervention. It's a story about how we're called to work hand in hand. Paul overturns the honor-shame culture. The jailer's about to commit suicide when Paul cries out, "Don't harm yourself, we're still here." An earthquake has opened the doors and loosened the chain from the ground, and the people inside the prison are free to go, but they don't, because they are all one. They won't go without the jailer. And Paul calls out to him, "Don't hurt yourself," counteracting that honor-shame culture. And the story tells us that Paul and the missionaries went home with that jailer, where the jailer bound and cleaned their wounds and fed them, and the whole household was baptized. This is the way it works, friends, through strange people in strange places. And if we work hand in hand with God, incredible things can happen. John's gospel this morning says, "I don't pray for these alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message." When the jailer says to Paul, "What do I have to do to be saved?" he says, "Believe in Jesus Christ." Well, friends, that is only the hook, because it took a lot more than belief for that jailer to walk out with those prisoners. It takes seeing the behavior. It takes seeing God in and through the bodies of other people. Jesus prays not just for his own, but all of those who hear the message. "I pray that they may be one in us, so the world may believe you sent me. I in them, you in me, that they may be made perfect in unity." When I look at the faces of those children in the shelter and tell them that Jesus is praying for them, and they weep, and I see how seriously they take the word and the songs and the prayer, and I think about the difference between us and them, I struggle with who's being held captive and who is free. And I wonder how, if we were all one, the world would be different. What must we do to be saved as individuals and as God's beloved community? How are we being exploited for profit or exploiting others for our personal or collective gain? Who is being scapegoated? Who are those people? And who are us Romans today? What must we do to be saved as church? How are we held captive? And how are we the keeper of the keys that holds others captive? Friends, we're going into elections. There's the Hillary camp, and there's the Trump camp, and there's people that are just mad and not going to be in a camp. When are we going to start acting like we're all one? When are we not going to see ourselves in camps? When are we going to start listening to each other and remembering that what I do affects you and what you do affects me, and that the circle of God's beloved community gets ever and ever larger to include all God's people, for the God that is bigger than we ever imagine? In the next month, as we live into our call and ministry and mission, may we be prayerful and thoughtful and remember that what we do and don't do affects so many people in the world. May we all be one. Amen.